tiresome sermons, he was deeply moved by his friend's concern.
"You're right," he said, wiping away his tears. "Thanks. I'll do what you say. I'll become a new man, right now. I agree, I'm not the type to succeed as a swordsman. I'll go to Edo and find a teacher. Then I'll study hard. I swear I will."
"I'll keep my eyes open for a good teacher as well as a good master you might work for. You could even work and study at the same time."
"It'll be like starting life over again. But there's something else that bothers me."
"Well, as I said, I'll do anything I can to help. That's the least I can do to make up for making your mother so angry."
"It's sort of embarrassing. You see, my companion is a woman. Not just any woman, it's... oh, I can't say it."
"Come on, act like a man.
Don't get angry. It's somebody you know."
"Who?"
"Akemi."
Startled, Musashi thought, could he have picked anybody worse? But he caught himself before saying it out loud. True, Akemi was not as sexually depraved as her mother, not yet at least, but she was well on her way. A bird on the wing with a destructive torch in its mouth. Besides the incident with Seijuro, Musashi strongly suspected there had been something going on between her and Kojiro. He wondered what perverse fate led Matahachi to women like Oko and her daughter. Matahachi misinterpreted Musashi's silence as a sign of jealousy.
"Are you angry? I told you honestly because I didn't think I should hide it."
"You simpleton. It's you I'm worried about. Have you been cursed since birth, or do you go out of your way to find bad luck? I thought you'd learn your lesson from Oko." In reply to Musashi's questions, Matachi told him how he and Akemi happened to be together.
"Maybe I'm being punished for deserting mother," he concluded. "Akemi hurt her leg when she fell into the ravine, and it began to get worse, so..."
"Oh, here you are, sir,"
said the old woman from the inn in the local dialect. Vague and senile, she put her arms behind her back and looked up at the sky, as though checking on the weather.
"The sick woman isn't with you," she added,
her flat inflection leaving it unclear as to whether she was asking or telling. Flushing slightly, Matahachi said,
"Akemi? Has something happened to her?"
"She's not in bed."
"Are you sure?"
"She was there a while ago, but she isn't now."
Though a sixth sense told Musashi what had happened, he merely said,
"We'd better go see."
Akemi's bedding was still spread out on the floor, but otherwise the room was bare. Matahachi cursed and made a futile circuit of the room. Face burning with rage, he said,
"No obi, no money. Not so much as a comb or hairpin. She's crazy. What's wrong with her, deserting me like this?"
The old woman was standing in the doorway.
"Terrible thing to do," she said, as if to herself. "That girl, maybe I shouldn't say it, but she wasn't sick. Putting on, she was, so she could stay in bed. I may be old, but I can see through things like that."
Matahachi ran out and stood staring down the white road curving along the ridge. The cow, lying under a peach tree whose blossoms had already darkened and fallen, broke the silence with a long, sleepy-sounding moo.
"Matahachi," said Musashi, "why stand there moping? Let's pray she finds a place where she can settle down and lead a peaceful life, and let it go at that."
A single yellow butterfly was tossed high in the swirling breeze before plummeting over the edge of a cliff.
"Your promise made me very happy," said Musashi. "Now, isn't it time to do something about it? Really try and make something of yourself?"
"Yes, I have to, don't I?"
mumbled Matahachi without enthusiasm, biting his lower lip to keep it from trembling. Musashi swung him around, diverting his eyes from the deserted road.
"Look here," he said cheerfully. "Your path has opened up of its own accord. Wherever Akemi's headed, it isn't right for you. Go now, before it's too late. Take the path that comes out between Sakamoto and Otsu. You should catch up with your mother before the day is out. Once you've found her, don't ever lose sight of her again. To emphasize the point, he brought Matahachi's sandals and leggings, then went into the inn and came back with his other belongings. Do you have any money? He asked. I don't have much myself, but you can have part of it. If you think Edo's the place for you, I'll go there with you. Tonight, I'll be at the Kara Bridge in Seta. After you find your mother, look for me there. I'm counting on you to bring her. After Matahachi left, Musashi settled down to wait for twilight and the reply to his letter. Stretching out on the bench in the back of the tea room, he closed his eyes and was soon dreaming of two butterflies drifting in the air, frolicking among intertwining branches. One of the butterflies he recognized, Otsu. When he awoke, the slanting rays of the sun had reached the back wall of the tea room. He heard a man say,
"However you look at it, it was a shoddy performance."
"You mean the Yoshiokas?"
"That's right. People had too much regard for the school because of Kempo's reputation. Looks like in any field, only the first generation counts for much. The next generation gets lackluster, and by the third, everything falls apart. You don't often see the head of the fourth generation buried by the side of the founder. Well, I intend to be buried right next to my great-grandfather. You're nothing but a stone cutter anyway. I'm talking about famous people. If you think I'm wrong, just look what happened to Hideyoshi's heir."
The stone cutters worked in a quarry in the valley, and around 3 o'clock every afternoon came up to the inn for a cup of tea. Earlier, one of them, who lived near Ichijoji, had claimed that he saw the battle from beginning to end. Having already told his story dozens of times, he could now deliver it with stirring eloquence, embroidering skillfully on facts, and mimicking Musashi's movements. While the stonecutters were listening raptly to his recital, four other men had arrived and taken seats out front. Sasaki Kojiro and three samurai from Mount Hiei. Their scowling faces made the workmen uneasy, so they'd picked up their teacups and retreated inside. But as the saga gathered steam, they began laughing and commentating, repeating Musashi's name frequently and with obvious admiration. When Kojiro reached the limit of his forbearance, he called loudly, "You there!"
"Yes, sir,"
they chorused, automatically bowing their heads.
"What's going on here? You!"
He pointed his steel-ribbed fan at the man.
"Talking as if you knew so much. Come out here. The rest of you, too. I'm not going to hurt you."
As they shuffled outdoors again, he continued,
"I've been listening to you using the praises of Miyamoto Musashi, and I've had enough. You're talking nonsense."
There were questioning looks and murmurs of puzzlement.
"Why do you consider Musashi a great swordsman? You say you saw the fight the other day, but let me assure you, I, Sasaki Kojiro, also saw it. As the official witness, I observed every detail. Later, I went to Mount Hiei and lectured to the student priests on what I'd seen. Moreover, at the invitation of some eminent scholars, I visited several subsidiary temples and gave more lectures. Now, unlike me, you men know nothing about swordsmanship."
Condescension was creeping into Kojiro's voice.
"You see only who won and who lost. Then you join the herd and praise Miyamoto Musashi as though he were the greatest swordsman who ever lived. Ordinarily, I wouldn't bother to refute the prattle of ignoramuses, but I feel it's necessary now, because your erroneous opinions are harmful to society at large. Moreover, I wish to expose your fallacies for the benefit of these distinguished scholars who accompany me today. Clean out your ears and listen carefully. I'll tell you what actually happened at the Spreading Pine and what kind of man Musashi is."
Obedient noises issued from the captive audience.
"In the first place," declaimed Kojiro, "let us consider what Musashi really has in mind, his ulterior purpose. To judge from the way he provoked this last bout, I can only conclude that he was trying desperately to sell his name, to make a reputation for himself. To do this, he singled out the House of Yoshioka, the most famous school of swordsmanship in Kyoto, and cleverly picked a fight. By falling victim to this ruse, the House of Yoshioka became Musashi's stepping stone to fame and success. What he did was dishonest. It was already common knowledge that the days of Yoshioka Kenpo were over, that the Yoshioka school had fallen into decline. It was like a withered tree or an invalid close to death. All Musashi had to do was give a push to an empty hulk. Anyone could have done the same, but no one did. Why? Because those of us who understand the art of war already knew the school was powerless. Second, because we did not wish to sully the honored name of Kenpo. Yet, Musashi chose to provoke an incident, to place challenging signs on the streets of Kyoto, to spread rumors, and finally, to make a great spectacle of doing what any reasonably skillful swordsman could have done. I couldn't begin to enumerate all the cheap, cowardly tricks he resorted to. Consider, for example, that he contrived to be late both for his bout with Yoshioka Seijuro and for his encounter with Denshiro. Instead of meeting his enemies head-on at the spreading pine, he came by a roundabout way and employed all sorts of base stratagems. It's been pointed out that he was only one man fighting against many. That's true, but it's only part of his devilish scheme for promoting his name. He knew full well that because he was outnumbered, the public would sympathize with him. And when it comes to the actual fighting, I can tell you, I observed it personally, it was little more than child's play. Musashi managed to survive for a time with his clever tricks. Then, when the chance to flee presented itself, he ran. Oh, I have to admit that to a certain extent he displayed a kind of brute strength. But that doesn't make him an expert swordsman. No, not at all. Musashi's greatest claim to fame is his ability to run fast. At making a rapid getaway, he is without equal. The words were now streaming from Kojiro's mouth like water over a dam. Ordinary people think it's difficult for a lone swordsman to fight against a great number of opponents, but 10 men are not necessarily 10 times stronger than 1 man. To the expert, numbers are not always important. Kojiro then gave a professional critique of the battle. It was easy to belittle Musashi's feat, for despite his valor, any knowledgeable observer could have picked out flaws in his performance. When he got around to mentioning Genjiro, Kojiro was scathing. He said the boy's murder was an atrocity, a violation of the ethics of swordsmanship that could not be condoned from any point of view. "And let me tell you about Musashi's background," he cried indignantly. He then revealed that within the past few days he'd met Osugi herself on Mount Hiei and had heard the whole long story of Musashi's duplicity. Sparing no details, he recounted the wrongs suffered by this sweet old woman. He ended by saying, "I shudder to think that there are people who shout the praises of this rogue. The effect on public morals is terrifying to contemplate, and this is the reason I've spoken at some length. I have no connection with the House of Yoshioka, nor do I have any personal grudge against Musashi. I've spoken to you fairly and impartially, as a man devoted to the way of the sword, and as one determined to follow righteously in that way. I've told you the truth. Remember it!" Falling silent, he eased his thirst with a cup of tea, then turned to his companions and remarked very quietly, "Ah, the sun's already low in the sky. If you don't start soon, it'll be dark before you reach the Miidera." The samurai from the temple rose to take their leave.
"Take good care of yourself," said one of them.
"We look forward to seeing you again when you return to Kyoto." The stonecutters saw their chance and, like prisoners freed by a tribunal, hastened back to the valley, which was now cloaked in purplish shadows and echoed with the singing of nightingales. Kojiro watched them go, then called into the inn, I'll put the money for the tea here on the table. By the way, do you have any matchlock fuses?
The old woman was squatting before the earthen oven, preparing the evening meal.
Fuses? She said. There's a bunch hanging in the corner back there. Take as many as you want.
He strode to the corner. As he was pulling two or three of them out of a sheaf, the rest fell on the bench below. Reaching to retrieve them, he couldn't help noticing the two legs stretched out on the bench. His eyes traveled slowly from legs to body to face. The shock was like a solid blow to the solar plexus. Musashi stared straight at him. Kojiro sprang back a step.
"Well, well," said Musashi, grinning broadly.
Unhurriedly, he stood up and went to Kojiro's side, where he stood silently, an amused and knowing expression on his face. Kojiro tried to smile back, but his facial muscles refused to obey. He realized instantly that Musashi must have overheard every word he'd said, and his embarrassment was all the more unbearable because he felt Musashi was laughing at him. It took him only a moment to recover his usual aplomb, but during that brief interval, his confusion was unmistakable.
"Why, Musashi, I didn't expect to find you here," he said.
"Nice to see you again."
"Yes, yes, indeed."
Regretting the words even as he spoke them, yet somehow unable to help himself, he went on.
"I must say, you've really distinguished yourself since I last saw you. It's hard to believe a mere human being could have fought the way you did. Let me congratulate you. You don't even seem to be any the worse for it."
The trace of a smile still on his lips, Musashi said with exaggerated politeness,
"Thank you for acting as witness that day. And thank you also for the critique you've just given of my performance. Not often are we allowed to see ourselves as others see us. I am much indebted to you for your comments. I assure you I won't forget them."
Despite the quiet tone and lack of rancor, the last statement sent a chill through Kojiro. He recognized it for what it was, a challenge that would have to be met at some future date. These two men, both proud, both headstrong, both convinced of their own rectitude, were bound to clash head-on sooner or later. Musashi was content to wait, but when he said, "I won't forget," he was only speaking the simple truth. He already regarded his most recent victory as a milestone in his career as a swordsman, a high point in his struggle to perfect himself. Kojiro's calumnies would not go unchallenged indefinitely. Though Kojiro had embellished his speech to sway his listeners, he actually saw the event very much as he had described it, and his honest opinion was not substantially different from what he had stated. Nor did he doubt for a moment the fundamental accuracy of his appraisal of Musashi.
"I'm glad to hear you say that," said Kojiro. "I wouldn't want you to forget. Nor will I."
Musashi was still smiling as he nodded his agreement. Entwining Branches.
"Otsu, I'm back," Jotaro called as he swept through the rustic front gate.
Otsu sat just inside the veranda with her arms propped on a low writing table, staring at the sky as she had been since morning. Under the gable was a wooden plaque bearing an inscription in white characters, "Hermitage of the Mountain Moon," the little cottage belonging to a priestly official at the Ginkakuji had, at Lord Karasumaru's request, been lent to Otsu. Jotaro plopped down in a clump of blossoming violets and began splashing his feet in the brook to wash off the mud. The water, which flowed directly from the garden of the Ginkakuji, was purer than fresh snow.
"Water's freezing," he observed with a frown, but the earth was warm, and he was happy to be alive and in this beautiful spot.
Swallows sang as if they, too, were pleased with the day. He rose, wiped his feet on the grass, and walked over to the veranda.
"Don't you get bored?" he asked.
"No, I have many things to think about."
"Wouldn't you like to hear some good news?"
"What news?"
"It's about Musashi. I heard he's not so far from here."
"Where?"
"I've been wandering around for days asking if anyone knew where he was, and today I heard he's staying at the Mudoji on Mount Hiei."
"In that case, I suppose he's all right."
"Probably, but I think we should go there right away, before he goes off someplace."
"I'm hungry. Why don't you get ready while I have something to eat?" "There are some rice dumplings wrapped in leaves. They're in that three-tiered box over there. Help yourself."
When Jotaro finished the dumplings, Otsu hadn't moved from the table.
"What's the matter?"
he asked, eyeing her suspiciously.
"I don't think we ought to go."
"Of all the stupid... 1 minute you're dying to see Musashi, and the next you start pretending you don't want to."
"You don't understand. He knows how I feel. That night when we met on the mountain, I told him everything, said all there was to say. We thought we'd never see each other alive again."
"But you can see him again, so what are you waiting for?"
"I don't know what he's thinking, whether he's satisfied with his victory or just staying out of danger. When he left me, I resigned myself to never being with him again in this life. I don't think I should go unless he sends for me."
"What if he doesn't do that for years?"
"I'll go on doing what I'm doing right now."
"Sit there and look at the sky?"
"You don't understand. But never mind."
"What don't I understand?"
"Musashi's feelings. I really feel I can trust him now. I used to love him heart and soul, but I don't think I believed in him completely. Now I do. Everything's different. We're closer than the branches of the same tree. Even if we're separated, even if we die, we'll still be together. So nothing can make me lonely anymore. Now I only pray he'll find the way he's searching for."
Jotaro exploded.
"You're lying!" he shouted. "Can't women even tell the truth? If you want to act that way, all right, but don't ever mention to me again how much you long to see Musashi. Cry your eyes out. It's all the same to me."
He'd put a lot of effort into finding out where Musashi had gone from Ichijoji, and now this. He ignored Otsu and didn't say a word the rest of the day. Just after dusk, a reddish torchlight crossed the garden, and one of Lord Karasumaru's samurai knocked on the door. He handed a letter to Jotaro, saying, "It's from Musashi to Otsu. His lordship said Otsu should take good care of herself." He turned and left. "It's Musashi's handwriting, all right," thought Jotaro. "He must be alive." Then, with a trace of indignation, "It's addressed to Otsu, not to me, I see." Emerging from the rear of the cottage, Otsu said,
"That samurai brought a letter from Musashi, didn't he?"
"Yes, but I don't suppose you'd be interested," he replied with a pout, hiding the letter behind his back.
"Oh, stop it, Jotaro. Let me see it,"
Otsu implored. He resisted for a time, but at the first hint of tears thrust the envelope at her.
"Ha!" he gloated. "You pretend you don't want to see him, but you can't wait to read his letter."
As she crouched by the lamp, the paper trembling in her white fingers, the flame seemed to have a special gaiety, a portent almost of happiness and good fortune. The ink sparkled like a rainbow, the tears on her eyelashes like jewels. Otsu, suddenly transported to a world she hadn't dared hope existed, recalled the ecstatic passage in Po Chui's poem, where the departed spirit of young Guifei rejoiced over a message of love from her bereaved emperor. She read the short message, then again read it.
"He must be waiting this very minute. I must hurry."
Though she thought she said the words aloud, she uttered not a sound. Flying into action, she wrote thank you notes to the owner of the cottage, to other priests at the Ginkakuji, and to all those who had been kind to her during her stay. She had gathered her belongings together, tied on her sandals, and was out in the garden before she noticed that Jotaro was still sitting inside nursing his peak.
"Come on, Jo, hurry up!"
"Going somewhere?"
"Are you still angry?"
"Who wouldn't be? You never think of anybody but yourself. Is there something so secret about Musashi's letter you can't even show it to me?"
"I'm sorry," she said apologetically. "There's no reason you shouldn't see it."
"Forget it! I'm not interested now!"
"Don't be so difficult. I want you to read it. It's a wonderful letter, the first he's ever sent me. And this is the first time he's asked me to come and join him. I've never been so happy in my life. Stop pouting and come with me to Seta, please!"
On the road through Shiga Pass, Jotaro maintained a grumpy silence. But eventually, he plucked a leaf to use as a whistle and hummed a few popular ditties to relieve the nocturnal stillness. Eventually, too, Otsu, prompted to make a peace offering, said,
"There are some sweets left from the box Lord Karasumaru sent the day before yesterday."
But dawn was breaking, and clouds beyond the pass were turning pink before he became his normal self again.
"Are you all right, Otsu? Aren't you tired?"
"A little. It's been uphill all the way."
"It'll be easier from now on. Look, you can see the lake."
"Yes, Lake Biwa. Where's Seta?"
"Over that way. Musashi wouldn't be there this early, would he?"
"I really don't know. It'll take us half the day to get there ourselves. Shall we take a rest?"
"Okay," he replied, his good humor restored. "Let's sit down under those two big trees over there."
The smoke of early morning cooking fires rose in strands, like vapors ascending from a battlefield. Through the mist stretching from the lake to the town of Ishiyama, the streets of Utsu were becoming visible. As he approached, Musashi drew his hand across his brow and looked around, glad to be back among people. Near the Miidera, as he started up the Bizoji slope, he had wondered idly which road Otsu would take. He had imagined earlier he might meet her on the way, but later decided this was unlikely. The woman who had taken his letter to Kyoto had informed him that though Otsu was no longer at the Karasumaru residence, his letter would be delivered to her. Since she would have received it no sooner than late evening, and would have had various things to do before leaving, it seemed probable that she would wait until morning before setting out. Passing a temple with a fine stand of old cherry trees, no doubt famous, he thought, for their spring blossoms, he had noticed a stone monument standing on a mound. Though he had caught only a glimpse of the poem inscribed thereon, it came back to him a few hundred yards farther down the road. It was from the Taiheiki. Recalling that the poem was connected with a tale he had once memorized, he began reciting it slowly to himself.
A venerable priest from the temple of Shiga, leaning on a 6-foot staff and so old that his white eyebrows grew together in a frosty peak on his forehead, was contemplating the beauty of Kannon in the waters of the lake when he chanced to catch sight of an imperial concubine from Kyogoku. She was on her way back from Shiga, where there was a great field of flowers, and when he saw her, he was overcome with passion. The virtue that he had so arduously accumulated over the years deserted him. He was engulfed in the burning house of desire, and... Now, how did that go? I seem to have forgotten some of it. Ah! And he returned to his hut made of sticks and prayed before the image of the Buddha. But a vision of the woman persisted. Though he called on the Buddha's name, his own voice sounded like the breath of delusion. In the clouds above the mountains at twilight, he seemed to see the combs in her hair. This made him sad. When he raised his eyes to the lonely moon, her face smiled back at him. He was perplexed and ashamed. Fearing that such thoughts would prevent him from going to paradise when he died,
He resolved to meet the damsel and reveal his feelings to her. In this way, he hoped to die a peaceful death. So he went to the imperial palace and, planting his staff firmly in the ground, stood waiting in the kickball court for an entire day and night.
"Pardon me, sir. You, on the cow."
The man seemed to be a day laborer of the sort found in the wholesale district. Coming around in front of the cow, he patted her nose and looked over her head at the rider.
"You must have come from the Mudoji," he said.
"I did, as a matter of fact. How did you know?"
"I lent this cow to a merchant. I guess he must have left her there. I rent her out, so I'll have to ask you to pay me for the use of her."
"I'd be happy to pay. But tell me, how far would you let me take her?"
"So long as you pay, you can take her anywhere. All you have to do is turn her over to a wholesaler in the town nearest where you're going. Then somebody else will rent her. Sooner or later, she'll get back here."
"How much would it cost me if I took her to Edo?"
"I'll have to check that at the stable. It's right on your way, anyhow. If you decide to rent her, you just have to leave your name at the office."
The wholesale district was near the ford at Uchidegahama. Since many travelers passed through there, Musashi thought it was just the place to freshen up and buy some things he needed. After the arrangements for the cow had been made, he had a leisurely breakfast and set out for Seta, savoring the prospect of seeing Otsu again. He no longer had any misgivings about her. Until their meeting on the mountain, she had always elicited a certain fear in him, but this time it was different. Her purity, intelligence, and devotion on that moonlit night had made his confidence in her deeper than love. Not only did he trust her, he knew she trusted him. He had vowed that once they were together again, he would refuse her nothing, provided, of course, it did not jeopardize his way of life as a swordsman. What had worried him before was the dread that if he allowed himself to love her, his sword would be blunted. Like the old priest in the story, he might lose the way. That she was well-disciplined was now evident. She would never become a hindrance or a fetter holding him back. His only problem now was to make sure that he himself did not drown in the deep pool of love.
"When we get to Edo," he thought, "I'll see she gets the type of training and education a woman needs. While she studies, I'll take Jotaro with me, and together we'll find a still higher plane of discipline. Then one day, when the time comes..."
Light reflected from the lake bathed his face in a gently flickering glow. The two sections of Kara Bridge, one 96-column spans and the other 23-column spans, were linked by a small island. On the island was an ancient willow tree, a landmark for travelers. The bridge itself was often called Willow Bridge.
"He's coming!"
cried Jotaro, dashing out of the tea shop onto the shorter section of the bridge, where he stood beckoning to Musashi with one hand and pointing to the tea shop with the other.
"There he is, Otsu! See? Riding a cow!"
He broke into a little dance. Soon Otsu was standing beside him, she waving her hand, he waving his basket hat. A broad grin lit Musashi's face as he drew near. He tied the cow to a willow tree, and the three of them entered the tea shop. Though Otsu had called wildly to Musashi while he was still on the far side of the bridge, now that he was beside her, words failed her. Beaming happily, she left the talking to Jotaro.
"Your wound's healed," said the boy, almost rhapsodically. "When I saw you on the cow, I thought maybe it was because you couldn't walk. But we still managed to get here first, didn't we? As soon as Otsu got your letter, she was ready to leave."
Musashi smiled, nodded, murmured ohs and ahs, but Jotaro's talk about Otsu and her love in front of strangers made him uncomfortable. At his insistence, they moved to a little porch in back, which was shaded by a wisteria trellis. Otsu remained too diffident to speak, and Musashi grew taciturn.
But Jotaro paid no heed. His rapid chatter mingled with the buzzing of bees and the whir of gadflies. He was interrupted by the proprietor's voice saying, "You'd better come inside. A storm's brewing. Look how dark the sky's getting above Ishiyamadera." He bustled about, putting away straw blinds and placing wooden rain shutters around the sides of the porch. The river had turned gray. Gusts of wind set the lavender wisteria blossoms into wild motion. All at once, a flash of light streaked through the sky, and the rain came pouring down in great torrents.
"Lightning!" cried Jotaro. "The first this year! Hurry up, get inside, Otsu! You'll get soaked! Hurry, Sensei! Oh, the rain came at just the right time! It's perfect!"
But if the shower was perfect for Jotaro, it meant embarrassment for Musashi and Otsu, for going back inside together would make them feel like starry-eyed lovers. Musashi held back, and Otsu, blushing, stood at the edge of the porch, no better protected from the elements than the wisteria blossoms. The man holding a piece of straw matting over his head as he ran through the blinding rain looked like a large self-propelled umbrella. Dashing under the eaves of a shrine gate, he smoothed his wet, rumpled hair and looked up questioningly at the swiftly moving clouds.
"It's just like midsummer," he grumbled.
No sound was audible above the pounding of the rain, but an abrupt flash of light sent his hands to his ears. Matahachi squatted fearfully near a statue of the god of thunder, which stood beside the gate. As suddenly as it had begun, the rain ceased. The black clouds parted, the sunshine streamed through, and before long the street had returned to normal. Somewhere in the distance, Matachi could hear the plinking of shamisen. As he started to move on, a woman dressed like a geisha crossed the street and walked directly up to him.
"Your name's Matahachi, isn't it?" she said.
"It is," he answered suspiciously.
"How did you know?"
"A friend of yours is at our shop now. He saw you from the window and told me to come get you."
Glancing around, he saw that there were several brothels in the neighborhood. Though he hesitated, the woman hurried him along toward her own.
"If you have other business," she said, "you don't have to stay long."
When they entered, the girls virtually fell all over him, wiping off his feet, removing his wet kimono, and insisting that he go to the parlor upstairs. When he asked who this friend was, they laughed and told him he would find out soon enough.
"Well," said Matahachi, "I've been out in the rain, so I'll stay until my clothes dry, but don't try to keep me here any longer than that. There's a man waiting for me at the bridge in Seta."
With much tittering, the women promised him he could leave in good time, meanwhile almost pushing him up the stairs. At the threshold of the parlor, he was greeted by a man's voice.
"Well, well, if it isn't my friend Inugami-sensei!"
For a moment, Matachi thought it was a case of mistaken identity, but when he looked into the room, the face seemed vaguely familiar.
"Who are you?"
he asked.
"Have you forgotten Sasaki Kojiro?"
"No,"
Matachi replied quickly.
"But why do you call me Inugami? My name's Honiden. Honiden Matahachi."
"I know, but I always remember you as you were that night on Gojo Avenue, making funny faces at a pack of stray curs. I think Inugami, God of the Dogs, is a good name for you."
"Cut it out. That's nothing to joke about. I had a terrible time that night, thanks to you."
"I don't doubt it. In fact, I sent for you today because I want to do you a good turn for a change. Come in, have a seat. Give the man some sake, girls."
"I can't stay. I have to meet someone in Seta. I can't afford to get drunk today."
"Who are you meeting?"
"A man by the name of Miyamoto. He's a childhood friend of mine, and..."
"Miyamoto Musashi? Did you make an appointment with him when you were at the inn in the pass?"
"How did you know?"
"Oh, I've heard all about you, all about Musashi, too. I met your mother, Osugi, is it? At the main hall on Mount Hiei. She told me about all the troubles she's gone through."
"You talked to my mother?
Yes, she's a splendid woman. I admire her, and so do all the priests on Mount Hiei. I tried to give her some encouragement.
Rinsing his cup in a bowl of water, he offered it to Matahachi and continued,
Here, let's drink together and wash away our old enmity. There's no reason to worry about Musashi if you've got Sasaki Kojiro on your side.
Matahachi refused the cup.
Why don't you drink?
I can't. I have to go.
As Matahachi started to get up, Kojiro grabbed him tightly by the wrist, saying,
Sit down!
But Musashi's waiting.
Don't be an ass. If you attack Musashi by yourself, he'll kill you instantly.
You've got it all wrong. He promised to help me. I'm going with him to Edo to make a new start in life.
You mean you'd rely on a man like Musashi?
Oh, I know. A lot of people say he's no good. But that's because my mother's gone around slandering him. But she's wrong. Has been all along. Now that I've talked to him, I'm more sure of that than ever. He's my friend, and I'm going to learn from him so that I can make something of myself too, even if it is a little late in the day.
Roaring with laughter, Kojiro slapped the tatami with his hand.
How could you be so innocent? Your mother told me you were unusually naive, but to be taken in by...
That's not true. Musashi's,
just be quiet. Listen, in the first place, how could you think of betraying your own mother by siding with her enemy? It's inhuman. Even I, a total stranger, was so moved by that valiant old lady that I swore to give her all the support I can.
I don't care what you think. I'm going to meet Musashi, and don't try to stop me. You, girl, bring my kimono. It should be dry by now.
Raising his drunken eyes, Kojiro commanded,
Don't touch it until I tell you to. Now look, Matahachi. If you plan to go with Musashi, you should at least talk to your mother first.
I'm going on to Edo with Musashi. If I make something of myself there, the whole problem will solve itself.
That sounds like something Musashi would say. In fact, I'd bet he put the words in your mouth. Anyway, wait till tomorrow, and I'll go with you to look for your mother. You have to listen to her opinion before you do anything. In the meantime, let's enjoy ourselves. Like it or not, you're going to stay here and drink with me.
This being a brothel, and Kojiro the paying guest, the women all came to his support. Matahachi's kimono was not forthcoming, and after a few drinks, he stopped asking for it. Sober, Matahachi was no match for Kojiro. Inebriated, he could be something of a menace. By the time day faded into night, he was demonstrating to one and all how much he could drink, demanding more, saying everything he should not say, airing all his resentments, in short, being a complete nuisance. It was dawn before he passed out, and noon before he came to again. The sun seemed all the brighter for the rain the previous afternoon. With Musashi's words echoing in his head, Matahachi longed to throw up every drop he had drunk. Fortunately, Kojiro was still asleep in another room. Matahachi slipped downstairs, made the women give him his kimono, and set off at a run for Seta. The muddy red water under the bridge was liberally sprinkled with Ishiyamadera's fallen cherry blossoms. The storm had broken the wisteria vines and strewn yellow caria flowers everywhere. After a lengthy search, Matahachi asked at the tea shop and was told that the man with the cow had waited until the shop closed for the night, then had gone to an inn. He had returned in the morning, but not finding his friend, had left a note tied to a willow branch. The note, which looked like a large white moth, said,
"Sorry I couldn't wait longer. Catch up with me on the way. I'll be looking for you."
Matahachi made good time along the Nakasendo, the high road leading through Kiso to Edo, but he had still not caught up with Musashi when he reached Kusatsu. After passing through Hikone and Toriimoto, he began to suspect he had missed him on the way, and when he reached Suribachi Pass, he waited half a day, keeping his eyes on the road the whole time.
It wasn't until he reached the road for Mino that Kojiro's words came back to him.
"Was I taken in after all?" he asked himself. "Did Musashi really have no intention of going with me?"
After much doubling back and investigation of side roads, he finally caught sight of Musashi just outside the town of Nakatsugawa. At first he was elated, but when he got close enough to see that the person on the cow was Otsu, jealousy took instant and complete control of him.
"What a fool I've been," he growled. "From the day that bastard talked me into going to Sekigahara until this very minute. Well, he can't walk all over me this way forever. I'll get even with him somehow, and soon."
The Male and Female Waterfalls.
"Phew, it's hot," Jotaro exclaimed. "I've never sweated like this on a mountain road before. Where are we?"
"Near Magome Pass," said Musashi. "They say it's the most difficult section of the high road."
"Well, I don't know about that, but I've had enough of this. I'll be glad to get to Edo. Lots of people there, right, Otsu?"
"There are, but I'm in no hurry to get there. I'd rather pass the time traveling on a lonely road like this."
"That's because you're riding. You'd feel different if you were walking. Look, there's a waterfall over there."
"Let's take a rest," said Musashi. The three of them made their way along a narrow path. All around, the ground was covered with wild flowers, still damp with morning dew. Coming to a deserted hut on a cliff overlooking the falls, they stopped. Jotaro helped Otsu off the cow, then tied the animal to a tree.
"Look, Musashi," said Otsu.
She was pointing at a sign that read, "Meoto no Taki." The reason for the name Male and Female Waterfalls was easy to understand, for rocks split the falls into two sections, the larger one looking very virile, the other one small and gentle. The roiling basin and rapids below the falls fired Jotaro with renewed energy. Half jumping, half dancing down the steep bank, he called up excitedly,
"There are fish down here!"
A few minutes later, he cried,
"I can catch them! I threw a rock and one rolled over dead!"
Not long after that, his voice, barely audible above the roar of the falls, echoed back from still another direction. In the shadow of the little hut, Musashi and Otsu sat among countless tiny rainbows made by the sun shining on the wet grass.
"Where has that boy gone, do you suppose?" she asked, adding, "He's really impossible to manage."
"Do you think so? I was worse than that at his age. Matahachi, though, was just the opposite. Really very well behaved. I wonder where he is. He worries me far more than Jotaro."
"I'm glad he's not here. I'd have to hide if he was."
"Why? I think he'd understand if we explained."
"I doubt it. He and his mother aren't like other people."
"Otsu, are you sure you won't change your mind?"
"About what?"
"I mean, mightn't you decide you really want to marry Matahachi?" Her face twitched with shock.
"Absolutely not,"
she replied, indignantly. Her eyelids turned orchid pink, and she covered her face with her hands, but the slight trembling of her white collar almost seemed to cry out,
"I'm yours, no one else's."
Regretting his words, Musashi turned his eyes toward her. For several days now, he had watched the play of light on her body. At night, the flickering glow of a lamp. In the daytime, the warm rays of the sun. Seeing her skin glisten with perspiration, he'd thought of the lotus blossom. Separated from her palate by only a flimsy screen, he'd inhaled the faint scent of her black tresses. Now the roar of the water became one with the throbbing of his blood, and he felt himself being swallowed up by a powerful impulse. Abruptly, he stood up and moved to a sunny spot where the winter grass was still high, then sat down heavily and heaved a sigh. Otsu came and knelt at his side, put her arms around his knees, and twisted her neck to look up into his silent, frightened face.
"What is it?" she asked. Did something I said make you angry? Forgive me. I'm sorry.
The more tense he became, and the harsher the look in his eyes, the more closely she clung to him. Then all at once, she threw her arms around him. Her fragrance, the warmth of her body, overwhelmed him.
Otsu!
He cried impetuously as he seized her in his brawny arms and threw her backward onto the grass. The roughness of the embrace took her breath away. She struggled free and crouched beside him.
You mustn't! You mustn't do that!
She shrieked hoarsely.
How could you? You, of all people!
She broke off, sobbing. His burning passion, suddenly chilled by the pain and horror in her eyes, Musashi came to himself with a jolt.
Why? He cried. Why?
Overcome by shame and anger, he himself was on the verge of tears. Then she was gone, leaving behind only a sachet, which had broken loose from her kimono. Staring blankly at it, Musashi groaned, then turned his face to the ground and let the tears of pain and frustration flow into the withered grass. He felt she'd made a fool of him, deceived, defeated, tortured and shamed him. Hadn't her words, her lips, her eyes, her hair, her body been calling out to him? Hadn't she labored to light a fire in his heart, then when the flames burst forth, fled in terror? By some perverse logic, it seemed that all his efforts to become a superior person had been defeated. All his struggles and privations had been rendered utterly meaningless. His face buried in the grass, he told himself he'd done nothing wrong, but his conscience wasn't satisfied. What a girl's virginity, vouchsafed to her for only a short period of her life, meant to her. How precious and sweet it was a question that never entered his mind. But as he breathed in the smell of the earth, he gradually regained his self-control. When he eventually dragged himself to his feet, the raging fire was gone from his eyes, and his face was devoid of passion. Trampling the sachet underfoot, he stood looking intently at the ground, listening, it seemed, to the voice of the mountains. His heavy black eyebrows were knit together just as they had been when he threw himself into battle under the spreading pine. The sun went behind a cloud, and the sharp screech of a bird split the air. The wind changed, subtly altering the sound of the falling water. Otsu, her heart fluttering like a frightened sparrow's, observed his agony from behind a birch tree. Realizing how deeply she had hurt him, she now longed to have him at her side again, but as much as she wanted to run to him and beg forgiveness, her body would not obey. For the first time, she realized that the lover she had given her heart to was not the vision of masculine virtues she had imagined. Discovering the naked beast, the flesh and blood and passions, clouded her eyes with sadness and fear. She had started to run away, but after 20 paces, her love caught and held her. Now, a little calmer, she began to imagine that Musashi's lust was different from that of other men. More than anything else in the world, she wanted to apologize and assure him she harbored no resentment for what he'd done.
He's still angry, she thought fearfully,
suddenly realizing he was no longer before her eyes.
Oh, what'll I do?
Nervously, she went back to the little hut, but there was only a cold white mist and the thundering of the water, which seemed to shake the trees and stir up vibrations all around her.
Otsu! Something awful's happened! Musashi's thrown himself into the water!
Jotaro's frantic cry came from a promontory overlooking the basin, just a second before he grabbed a wisteria vine and began descending, swinging from branch to branch like a monkey. Though she hadn't caught the actual words, Otsu heard the urgency in his voice. She raised her head in alarm and began clambering down the steep path, slipping on the moss, then clinging to rocks to steady herself. The figure, just visible through the spray and mist, resembled a large rock, but was actually Musashi's naked body.
Hands clasped in front of him, head bowed, he was dwarfed by the 50-foot flood cascading down on him. Halfway down, Otsu stopped and stared in horror. Across the river, Jotaro stood, similarly transfixed.
"Sensei!"
he cried.
"Musashi!"
Their shouts never reached Musashi's ears. It was as though 1,000 silver dragons were nipping at his head and shoulders, the eyes of 1,000 water demons exploding around him. Treacherous eddies tugged at his legs, ready to pull him to his death. One false rhythm in breathing, one faltering heartbeat, and his heels would lose their tenuous hold on the algae-covered bottom. His body would be swept up in a violent current from which there was no return. His lungs and heart seemed to be collapsing under the incalculable weight, the total mass of the Magome Mountains falling on him. His desire for Otsu died a slow death, for it was closely akin to the hot-blooded temperament without which he would never have gone to Sekigahara or accomplished any of his extraordinary feats. But the real danger lay in the fact that at a certain point, all his years of training became powerless against it, and he sank again to the level of a wild, mindless beast. And against an enemy like this, formless and hidden, the sword was utterly useless. Bewildered, perplexed, conscious of the devastating defeat he'd suffered, he prayed that the raging waters might bring him back to his quest for discipline.
"Sensei! Sensei!"
Jotaro's shouts had become a tearful wailing.
"You mustn't die! Please don't die!"
He, too, had clasped his hands in front of his chest, and his face was contorted as if he, too, were bearing the weight of the water, the sting, the pain, the cold. Glancing across the river, Jotaro suddenly felt himself go limp. He couldn't make any sense out of what Musashi was doing. Apparently, he was determined to stay under the torrent until he died, but now Otsu, where was she? He was sure she'd leaped to her death in the river below. Then, above the sound of the water, he heard Musashi's voice. The words weren't clear. He thought it might be a sutra, but then, maybe they were angry oaths of self-recrimination. The voice was full of strength and life. Musashi's broad shoulders and muscular body exuded youth and vigor, as if his soul had been cleansed and was now ready to begin life afresh. Jotaro began to feel that whatever had been wrong had passed. As the light of the evening sun made a rainbow above the falls, he called, "Otsu!" and dared to hope that she had left the cliffside simply because she thought Musashi was in no real danger. "If she's confident he's all right," he thought, "there's nothing for me to worry about. She knows him better than I do, right down to the bottom of his heart." Jotaro skipped lightly down to the river, found a narrow place, crossed it, and climbed up the other side. Approaching silently, he saw that Otsu was inside the hut, huddled on the floor with Musashi's kimono and swords clutched to her bosom. Jotaro sensed that her tears, which she made no effort to hide, were somehow not ordinary tears. And without really understanding what had happened, he felt it was of grave concern to Otsu. After a couple of minutes, he slipped quietly back to where the cow lay in the whitish grass and sprawled out beside her.
"At this rate, we'll never get to Edo," he said.
Book 5. Sky. The Abduction. Beyond the pass, the snow on Mount Koma glistened in lance-like streaks, while on Mount Ontake, visible through the faintly reddish tree buds, it lay in scattered patches. The light green heralding the growing season seemed to shimmer along the high road and in the fields. Otsu daydreamed. Jotaro was like a new plant, stubborn and hardy. It would take an awful lot to trample him, to keep him down for long. He was growing fast these days. Occasionally, she thought she caught a glimpse of the man he would one day be.